Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're going to discuss today the last, and this is an amazing remark to make, as it were, 4 prime ministers. So we have Theresa May, who was prime minister from 2016 to 2019, Boris Johnson, who was prime minister from 2019 to 2022, Liz Truss, who was prime minister in 2022, slightly longer than the clock is going to take to tick the hour, and Rishi Sunak, who's been prime minister from 2022 to today. And obviously, there are issues involved in discussing these from a historical perspective, which is mine, and that is that we are in no shape or form near not only the 30-year rule, but in fact, even the informal disclosure of material by participants is very partial indeed. And by the nature of things, we have, as it were, a shifting present. And when you have a shifting present, then looking back to the past becomes not so much complex, because always the present shifts, but becomes more challenging as you try and determine what aspects of the present you wish to look for progenitors to, let alone explanations for. And we're also talking about 4 prime ministers who had only so much in common. I mean, they were all members of the Conservative Party, and they all were prime ministers in the aftermath of the referendum vote for Brexit. And they all had to address the issues raised by that. But on the other hand, there were also significant contrasts, not just in character and tone, and indeed the longevity of their period in office, but also in terms of the issues they had to address, whether one's thinking of the COVID pandemic or the war in Ukraine. Not all of the issues have been coterminous with the entire period that we're talking about. And as well as in the more narrowly political sense, there was, and there appeared to the electorate to be, a significant difference between the Labour Party led by Jeremy Corbyn, which was the situation until the aftermath of the 2019 general election, and the Labour Party led by Keir Starmer. Because although Keir Starmer was a member of the cabinet, shadow cabinet under Jeremy Corbyn, and presumably regarded himself as totally involved in the decision-making process and didn't choose to resign from either that cabinet or indeed from the Labour Party, as other people of some principle did, nevertheless, he was perceived, fairly or unfairly, by the electorate as in some way significantly different. And that created political issues and problems for the Conservatives. So that's, as it were, the background of what we're thinking about. And what I'm going to try and do is not just talk in terms of personalities, because that will only take one so far. One is in danger of allowing one's personal prejudices or personal suppositions. I've come across all 4 of them myself, but that doesn't mean I, as it were, have an internal view, just an external view, obviously. And the internal view that one might get from reading historical documentation is just simply not really there at the moment. So there is always the difficulty of that. But what I want to do is try and move away from personality, though I dare say Graham will push me quite reasonably in that direction, and try and look for commonalities. And I mean, obviously, you might well think that the commonalities between somebody of clear probity, in the case of Theresa May, and somebody of clear lack of probity, in the case of Boris Johnson, may well be sort of really testing the limits for historical analysis. But as I said, we have got the fact that all of these politicians had to deal with the problems of office, And that was a significant point because they didn't have the luxury of being able to expound, once they were in office, of being able to expound political viewpoints, oblivious of the fact they were still having to run both government and party. But they also all shared the difficulties of the very complicated nature of the Conservative Party in that period, which had tensions between the party in Parliament and the party in the country, both of them being divided, which had issues in terms of the leadership of cabinet. And I think it's fair to say that all of the three ex-prime ministers we're talking about have commented about the fact that they didn't feel that they enjoyed the support that they would have preferred from within their party. And then on top of that, there was the difficulty of trying to implement or determine what the Brexit referendum meant in practice, and then to try and implement that, a difficulty magnified by the fact that although the two main political parties had gone in to the general election of 2015 and the referendum pledged to observe the results of that, I think it's fair to say that the Labour Party in opposition, which had a significant number of MPs and an even greater number of MPs after the 2017 general election, wasn't mindful of doing so. And the Conservative Party found it very difficult to unite over that itself. So these were difficult years. And of course, the actual context was hard. There was the context in terms of changing viewpoints on the part of other European states and the European Commission, on the part of the relationship with the United States, and indeed also in terms of greater global power politics, an issue centered and accentuated by the Russian invasion, or one should possibly say the second Russian invasion of Ukraine, but one that clearly predated that. So all of these pose difficulties. And in many respects, these difficulties were far greater than those posed by previous governments, at least going back to the crisis of the mid-1980s, early and mid-1980s, beginning roughly with the Falklands War and ending with the success over the National Union of Mine Workers, in which the government of the day, the government of Margaret Thatcher, faced an external war, which it was unclear that they could win, faced a major ally, the United States, which it wasn't clear what its position would be on this conflict, faced internal disaffection outside the law and in defiance of it, in the case of the National Union of Mine Workers, and faced a terrorist campaign pledged to slaughter its way through to the end in the case of the Provisional IRA, which tried to assassinate the Prime Minister. So it's since then we've had it, although it may not have seemed at the time, relatively easy. And the return of difficulty in politics, in part created tensions and would have created tensions for whichever political party had been in power, but created more tensions, I would suggest, because in the case of Brexit, it was actually necessary to do something. And that meant that legislation had to be carried through the parliamentary process. And against it, one might add, a more difficult environment because of the presence of a independent-minded Supreme Court, and because of the tensions in the relationships within the British question, specifically with Scotland and with Northern Ireland, because actually nobody really cared what the Welsh government thought. And I think one could add to that that had the Conservative government, or indeed had it been a Labour government, had the Conservative government simply had the task, difficult as that would have been, of doing what Mrs. Thatcher had to do, which is, in the background of a parliamentary majority, take part in very difficult, very highly difficult and problematic and executive decisions, which is what they fundamentally were in terms of suppressing a violent strike and waging war and resisting terrorism, that would have been hard enough. But in the need, in addition, to fight a settlement through Parliament in the face of significant opposition was, although differently difficult, very difficult. So that's where I would like to start. And I suppose our first Prime Minister that comes to mind is obviously Theresa May. And there, I think one or two points could be made. Number one, obviously, she made a terrible mistake, as she admitted, in the management of the 2017 general election. I mean, I remember thinking when I was told, that it's been called and how long the period was for the election campaign, I thought at once and said at once, this is a mistake. Going on so long is just wrong. I was talking to a SPAD on the day and I said, this is just a mistake. But I think it's fair to say that with Theresa May, one could add a couple of other points which tend not to be emphasized. One is that the fortuitous pulling out of the campaign by Andrea Leadsom, who had initially going to go to the country in the sense of the membership of the Conservative Parliamentary Party in order for the two of them to contest the leadership. The fact that she had to pull out, or felt she had to pull out, I'm not sure she did, but she felt she had to pull out in the face of a storm because of a remark she made, meant in a sense that possibly Theresa May as Prime Minister did not have the initial mandate that would have been preferable vis-a-vis her relations with the parliamentary party. I mean, I think that's one point. A second point I think I would like to make is that I certainly got it wrong. I thought it would be very difficult to reach an agreement with the European Union, but relatively possible to get that such an agreement, if reached, through the Parliamentary Conservative Party in the House of Commons. In fact, it turned out to be the exact opposite. It proved to be easier than anticipated to reach an agreement with the European Union, and in fact, a sensible agreement that, however irritating it might have been to some ultras, would in fact have been in accordance with the Conservative tradition going right back to the Duke of Wellington and his eventual support for Catholic emancipation and then parliamentary reform, the sense that you need to compromise, that the country had been divided, that the party had been divided, and that fundamentally we did actually want to end up with good relations with our former partners. So in practical terms, she was able to negotiate an agreement, but then could not, as it were, if you wish to use the term, sell it to the parliamentary party, partly because Labour, in marked contradiction to its policies when there'd been the initial joining of the European Economic Community, did not permit the open vote on the issue and chose to ignore its prior public statements about what its commitment would be to the referendum result. So I think that point is worth drawing out. And lastly, and of course, Theresa May was not by any means the first prime minister in this respect. Her relations with some of her cabinet ministers and some of the members of the parliamentary party were less than easy, which of course continued a situation we had seen it differently, but we had seen with David Cameron, we'd seen it with Gordon Brown, we'd seen it with Tony Blair, we'd seen it with John Major, we'd seen it with Margaret Thatcher. I mean, indeed, of recent prime ministers, probably the two that had had the easiest relations with their parliamentary party were Gordon Brown and James Callaghan, neither of whom were actually a tremendously good advertisement for that, and both of whom had lost the only parliamentary election they contested. So although it's often argued that Theresa May had particularly poor relations with her party, I think people who are arguing that tend to forget previous prime ministers, and indeed tend to forget that the problem was not the poor relations, the problem was the need to get the legislation through Parliament. Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. I want to start by not addressing the issue of Theresa May's Brexit bill, but actually just taking it from a slightly different angle, which is to say, no one can judge Theresa May or even any of the period that the Tories were in power during the period we're talking about without saying, well, it was dominated by how to implement the Brexit referendum, and any other ideas or policies were put to the sidelines. But I mean, here's an alternative thought, and this is that under Theresa May, there weren't or wouldn't have actually been much of a policy. If we look at her agenda, it's very hard to say what Mayism would have involved, or you know, in what way it would have been different from the David Cameron years, for example, in terms of policy. I was wondering whether you, looking at it, see something distinctive, not about her character, but about what her beliefs were, which have always been a little difficult to pin down.
Well, I think that the remarks she enunciated on the day she gained power reflected a kind of what you might call conservative sort of Christian socialism, almost, a kind of which was associated in a way with some of the mood music coming out of her first year, in the sense that she took the Cameroonian idea of a sort of big tent and tried to give it a greater energy in terms of the people left behind. She had, you know, she's a devout Christian. She had has a strong social conscience, and believed that the party of opportunity and freedom, which is the Conservative Party, should also be a party of responsibility and care. And I think actually she communicated that very well. Now, what that would mean in practice is difficult to say, because everything did, as you say, get swept away by Brexit. But the kind of idea that a lot of the working class had been left behind was very much enunciated by her, and I think reflected her social conscience and also her awareness as an experienced Home Secretary of the background of much lawlessness in parts of the country.
I just wonder how that would translate it into policy. And what I particularly have in mind is that at the time of her disastrous, she still won it, but disastrous 2017 general election campaign, there are really two policies which stood out in her manifesto. One was getting Brexit done, a phrase literally later deployed more effectively by Boris Johnson, but getting Brexit done, and also her social care reforms. As soon as during the campaign those social care reforms came into turbulence, she just dropped them. And it made me think maybe that there wasn't that much more beyond. I mean, the kind of Christian conservative perspective which she had, I mean, that was really articulated for her by Nick Timothy, who she promptly sacked after the 2017 election campaign. And once he had gone, she never really found her way again, never even found her voice again. She became totally inarticulate.
Well, I mean, let's go through that. I think as you will remember, that election campaign moved in painful slow motion, with the Conservatives doing very well, And then the discussion about how best to fund care for the elderly, which was hijacked by the Liberal Democrats' claim that this was a tax on dementia, which was absolute rubbish. And the government lost its way on that point. And I think now there's several things you could say. You could argue, I would argue, that it did lose its way, but I would also argue that the nation lost its way, that in a sense, what the government was enunciating was perfectly sensible, that it wanted care, but that there would be costs that were going with it, and people simply weren't interested in that. And on top of that, there was this astonishing popularity for Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that we had, you know, several near misses in my lifetime politically. And you could argue the fate of the union was a near miss in 2014. And you could argue the fact that Jeremy Corbyn clearly thought he was going to win the 2017 general election. He had a sort of Neil Kinnock moment, if you like. And 40% of those who voted for him. It's an astonishing figure. And of course, the impact of that was exaggerated by the nature of an unreformed representation, the Boundary Commission not having been enacted. So that although Theresa May got a very, very, very substantial vote, it didn't play to her advantage electorally. Once you are in that position, it is then very difficult to push through legislation. And what I think you might interestingly say, if we're looking for commonalities, you could argue that May was under enormous problems by being in the front line of the Brexit issue, the result of the 2017 general election, and a Corbynism that hadn't yet been exposed as the rotten, corrupt system of unreality and anti-Semitism that it was. You had Johnson, who, I mean, obviously Jeremy Corbyn won the 2019 election, he just won it for the Conservatives, but Johnson, who whatever he might have amounted to, was hijacked by a combination of the pandemic and his own inadequacies. Truss was hijacked by the money markets, and Sunak has found that, although I'm sure his intentions are good, he has a weak position within the party, only so much money as a result of the vast amounts splurged over COVID, and on top of that is facing a strong Labour Party. So that each of these prime ministers, although in many senses, not just superficially, in many senses very different, in fact, have the same problem, that they have very little control over circumstance. In fact, the exact opposite. And on top of that, a political party that, to put it mildly, is out of control.
Well, I was on that very point. I was very interested in what you were saying about the difficulties Theresa May had, not with negotiating a deal, but with negotiating with her own party. And I'd want to suggest maybe that the problem was at least partly of her own making, by which I mean she misunderstood what Brexit was about. As she saw it was a vote against the free movement of people. And the deal she negotiated had that aspect at its core, but it kept, through a form of alignment, the single market and single market regulation, which was defended as, well, it will be good for trade, it's what business wants, it's the compromise of, on the one hand, ending free movement but still keeping frictionless trade going. But it seems to me that was a misunderstanding not only of the issues of sovereignty, which is what actually many people who voted for Brexit were fundamentally committed to, also a misunderstanding of the pro-Brexit wing of the Parliamentary Conservative Party, which was very focused on the constitutional issues of sovereignty rather than free movement, but also the compromise she negotiated was was the worst option of all, by which I mean that there's a logic to having European regulation, which as a member of the European Union, you have a part say in creating, and there's a logic to being an independent country. But there isn't a logic by the deal that she created, which was Britain would continue to have European regulation, but because it had left the European Union,
well,
would have...
Can I just say, Graham, one or two things about that? First of all, as we've already discussed in a previous programme, I would argue that Britain, prior to leaving the European Union and after leaving the European Union, is in a similar position, in the sense that prior to leaving, it was a semi-detached member of the European Union. It wasn't in the Euro, it wasn't in the Schengen area, and it wasn't, I think it's fair to say, central to whatever you mean by the European Union project. After leaving the European Union, Britain is also in the semi-detached position, putting more weight on other factors, such as clearly at the present moment, NATO and confrontation with Russia. But the whatever one might think about the strengths or otherwise of the sovereignty argument, there was never going to be total sovereignty. I think that's a nebulous point and rather naive. I'm not meaning you're naive. I mean, some of the rhetoric was rather naive. And I think what I would say is this, that that it was a very hard call in the aftermath of a divided result to then go for a very hard exit. I think that was tricky, not least because parts of the British Isles didn't want to go in that direction. Now, one of the reasons, as I understand it, that a compromise was sought was in part to try and deal with this British dimension. I myself had a one-to-one conversation with the Prime Minister shortly, as it were, before she fell. And she said and emphasized that trying to save the union had been one of her key issues and parameters in her negotiations with the European Commission. And at that stage, I mean, now they seem to have run adrift on issues of sexual identity, but at that stage, it did appear that a very hard Brexit would give enough to help the SNP win the next referendum. And that was not, by most people, desirable. And on top of that, there was the Northern Irish issue. So I think it was more complicated than the one of maladroit compromise versus integrity. I think that was a, you know, as it were, a mal pose. I think any prime minister has to try and address a multitude of audiences and agendas. Those audiences, including their own cabinet, parliamentary party, and party in the country. And of that group, the last group, I think it's probably fair to say many of those, though by no means all, supported a harder Brexit than Theresa May wanted. I think it's fair to say the majority of the parliamentary party repeatedly showed in its votes it's quite happy with her result. It was only a minority that were the so-called Spartans. I think only 25 in all three votes, which didn't suggest that argument had won an enormous amount of support in the parliamentary party. And obviously the bulk of the cabinet agreed with her. So I wouldn't agree with you at suggesting that she was an isolated figure led astray by a lack of backbone. But then on top of that, there were the agendas of business, the financial system, the other constituent governments of the British Isles, as established by Tony Blair, Britain's allies, the United States, etc., etc. So I think it is more complex. And obviously, if one wants to look at politics through the and, you know, I'm a conservative, but if you want to look at politics through simply the parameters of the op-ed pieces of the Daily Telegraph, then you would present Theresa May as a, you know, as a fool and as unsuccessful. I remember a cartoon in the Telegraph mocking her failure to be able to restrict illegal immigrants into Britain. Well, that doesn't exactly look so brilliant from the perspective of what has happened since. And I think, again, you know, politics as the art of the possible is not something that a conservative ought to mock. I mean, on the whole, ideology in my lifetime was something that I associated particularly with the left. One of the sadnesses has been that there has often been an unthinking parroting of left-wing approaches by some on the right.
Well, the art of the possible is one thing. For Theresa May, it proved impossible.
Yes.
The same. And actually, the approach which ended up reaping dividends was the one that Boris Johnson...
He was very lucky in his opposition. Mr. Johnson was very lucky that he had Jeremy Corbyn Mark II, not Jeremy Corbyn Mark I. And also that there was a genuine sense of enough was enough. Everybody was a bit fed up. I think that was very important, and that helped him enormously.
I agree. I mean,
just want to continue on this. Spoke for the party in a number of constituencies. And I was told by parliamentary candidates that there was in no way they were mentioning Boris Johnson on the doorstep, that what they were mentioning on the doorstep, this was the Conservative candidates, was Jeremy Corbyn, that they knew that Boris Johnson was not, for many people, a vote winner, particularly in the north of England. But that Jeremy Corbyn, who was seen as unpatriotic at best, was a vote loser for Labour. So I think one has to be careful here. The argument that Johnson won, I use the phrase, I wasn't being flippant. The person that won the 2019 general election was Jeremy Corbyn. He won it for the Conservatives. And I think that Boris Johnson did not. I mean, I have to say, I know at the present moment that the press is very excited at the prospect of the Conservatives doing badly, as it looks as though they will do in the local elections. And then Mr. Johnson is already on his manoeuvres, indicating that he believes, he's made it quite clear to those people who know him, that he believes that the Conservatives will lose the next general election, but that if he is the leader, they will lose it less badly than if Mr. Sunak is the leader, and that therefore he ought to replace Mr. Sunak. So therefore, what one is getting is a reading back in order to endorse an argument now of the pro-Johnson exposition. And of course, that's been helped for Johnson by the fact that Liz Truss did not prove a success. So that the difficulty on the right, which is to provide a viable solution to a man who's clearly a charlatan, but the right has failed to do that. So the right, therefore, has to say nice things about Johnson. But let's be clear about this. The man is not very impressive. He had lots of stupid ideas. Do you remember such brilliant ones as, for example, the bridge that was going to join Scotland to Northern Ireland? You know, lots of stupid ideas. His integrity, the people he gave contracts to, he pushed forward. His integrity is at best highly suspect. I'll just put it like that. And I suspect historians in the future, with the archives open, are going to have a lot more exciting and interesting things to say. His idea of himself as a neo-Churchill is laughable. And I find that it's disappointing that people, because they don't like the current prime minister, and there's many reasons not to like the current prime minister, he lacks charisma, he's got flaws, but because of that, they think that they then have to play up Johnson. What I would rather see is a viable and sensible candidate arise from the, you know, because if Sunak loses, presumably he'll need replacing. It would be nice to see a better candidate emerge rather than the idea that we retread somebody who, you know, is Britain's version of Donald Trump.
Well, we were saying at the outset about, you know, to what extent we talk about personalities and to what extent we talk about a policy. Four different prime ministers with all totally different personalities. But I suspect when the next general election is called, a Labour line of argument will be, you know, for, they'll wrap in the coalition years. They will say, you know, 14 years of failed Tory government with very little to show for it. Do you see consistencies of policy between these four very different leaders, which would allow Labour to say, actually, the Conservative policy has been consistent and consistently harmful? Or should really we see a party that has been in power, but which has tried to pursue radically different objectives, depending on which prime minister was at its head at any one time?
Well, I think that's very interesting. I certainly think in terms of fiscal stability, there were real differences between the attempt to ensure fiscal stability, which was a characteristic of the Cameron-Osborne years, continued by May, and the woeful failure of the Johnson administration with Sunak as Chancellor of the Exchequer. I think they blew about $400 billion on COVID, completely ridiculous response to it, and fiscally very, very, very imprudent. And indeed, in many respects, Johnson is a left-wing prime minister who has hijacked the Conservative Party. And now, he would no doubt present himself as in Churchill's shadow, Churchill starting, for being a period of time as a liberal and arguing that this is what he has done. I think one's got to be much more careful here. I think that the size and of the state, which I think will be a problem when Labour comes in, has not been constrained sufficiently by the Conservatives. But I think there have still been differences in tendency among those Conservatives that have been in power.
So what would you see as a persistent guiding philosophy then between these four prime ministers, if there is one? Maybe there's no philosophical thread at all.
Well, I think you might well be right on that latter point. I don't think any of them, they've all had obviously qualities in the sense that to be prime minister requires a degree of ability, and only one of them, Johnson, was lazy. So the others have had a degree of credibility that I think is impressive. But I would argue that none of them have been of the caliber of Margaret Thatcher. And I think that by which I'm thinking in terms of their ability to handle the range of their brief. And I think that that is a matter of note. But then I don't think any of the recent Labour leaders have been in that situation. So we then end up with an interesting point. As you may know, I've written extensively on the topic of strategy, and a common theme that's been discussed by people like myself who write on strategy is, did the West lose touch of the principles and practice of strategy in the 2000s and 2010s, a argument that's been applied obviously to Britain, but also to the United States, which is the lead power here. And I think there is, and that's a point that's been made irrespective of whether you're talking about governments of left or right. So you could argue, if you wanted to do, that there has not only been a failure in the broader sense, not just the failure of military and foreign and geopolitical strategy, but more generally, you could argue, yes, there has been a failure in Britain of Conservative governments, but that's also part and parcel of a failure of Labour governments, a failure of Liberal Democrat attitudes, a failure of the SNP. And you could then discuss why that is. Is it the case that the nation as a whole, as judged by its electors, are unrealistic, that we're living beyond our means, that we got used first with North Sea oil and then with quantitative easing to cheap money and to not having to think through things? Is it the case that we've been lazy compared to people in the tiger economies, or indeed in some of, not all by any means, of the economies in Europe, or sorry, in continental Europe? We could discuss that. Is it the case that government itself has become too difficult, that there are too many constraints on what government can do, that the whole process of trying to implement policy is too difficult, whether you're looking at it from left or right or centre, and that the Brexit issue was just a manifest of the difficulty of taking through the referendum result, was just a manifestation of that. Whereas paradoxically, referenda were seen as successful because, in essence, the previous referenda that would have made major changes did not occur. The previous referenda in the early 2010s. I'm not talking about the 1997 process. So, you know, there are a whole host of issues in which one can move aside from saying, oh, well, this is just the deficiencies of Conservatives or the Conservative political party, parliamentary party, or conservatism as a philosophy. I mean, I myself, obviously, as a Conservative, like the idea of caution towards change, of trying to live in terms of a sense of the national interest, in terms of as much freedom as possible for individuals, in terms of a restricted size and pretensions for the state. And therefore, I have to say that the way in which the COVID pandemic was used as an opportunity for a most astonishing expansion of state power was one I found deeply troubling. And I actually think, as you may have gathered, my view of Mr. Johnson is not high. And I think that under his prime ministership, the Conservative government behaved like a Labour government, and it made precious little difference who was running the country at that point. And I think that the effective opposition was led by members of parliament, such as Sir Graham Brady, who were criticising in the House the extension of government power. So I don't actually think that your argument, which is essentially that Mr. Johnson represents a sense of national sovereignty, stands water. I mean, to my view, national sovereignty means very little if it is simply a view established from Whitehall telling us what to do in all and every respect. And I, as a Conservative, think that one ought to try and have as many points of freedom in the country as possible, accepting the difficulties that pose and accepting that one will not agree with all the manifestations of that freedom. But that, to me, is what democracy is about. And I think we were in serious danger in 2020 and 2021 of losing sight of what democracy meant in this country. And I think that was more of a challenge than the fact that, without a doubt, and I would agree with you entirely, that the Euro-federalism of the European Union also is a challenge to British freedom and a challenge to British freedoms and a challenge to whatever you mean by sovereignty. I agree with you completely, but I think that that challenge also came from the British government in 2020 and 2021. And I'm not talking here about, you know, the ludicrous idiots who didn't want to have jabs. I would have a jab a week if that made me healthier. What I'm talking about is the idea that the only source of merit and policy in the country had to come from government. I thought that was truly troubling.
Yes, well, look, we'll have to end it there, unfortunately, because we're out of time, but it's a very particularly somber note for people who believe in less government to end on, but end it there we must. Professor Jeremy Black, reflecting on the recent occupants of Downing Street and the problems they had in store. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.